This is Cats Will Be Cats by the very Reverend P.G. Woodhouse. There had fallen upon the bark parlor of Angler's Rest one of those soothing silences which from time to time punctuate the nightly feasts of reason and flows of soul in that cozy resort. It was broken by a whiskey and splash.
"I've been thinking a lot," said the whiskey and splash, addressing Mr. Muller, "about that cat of yours, that Webster."
"Has Mr. Muller got a cat named Webster?" asked a small port, who had rejoined our little circle after an absence of some days. The sage of the bar parlor shook his head smilingly. "Webster," he said, "did not belong to me. He was the property of the Dean of Bolsover, who, on being raised to a bishopric and sailing from England to take up his episcopal duties at his see of Bongo Bongo in West Africa, left the animal in care of his nephew, my cousin Edward's son, Lancelot the artist. I was telling these gentlemen the other evening how Webster for a time completely revolutionized Lancelot's life. His early upbringing at the deanery had made him austere and censorious, and he exerted on my cousin's son the full force of a powerful and bigoted personality. It was as if Savonarola or some minor prophet had suddenly been introduced into the carefree bohemian atmosphere of the studio. He stared at Lancelot and unnerved him, explained a pint of bitter.
He made him shave daily and knock off smoking, added a lemon sour.
He thought Lancelot's fiancée Gladys Bingley worldly, said a rum and milk, and tried to arrange a match between him and a girl called Brenda Carberry Purbright.
But one day, concluded Mr. Mulliner, Lancelot discovered that the animal, for all its apparently rigid principles, had feet of clay and was no better than the rest of us. He happened to drop a bottle of alcoholic liquid, and the cat drank deeply of its contents and made a sorry exhibition of himself, with the result that the spell was, of course, instantly broken. What aspect of the story of Webster, he asked the whiskey and splash, has been engaging your thoughts?
The psychological aspect, said the whiskey and splash. As I see it, there's a great psychological drama in this cat. I visualize his higher and lower selves warring. He has taken the first false step, and what will be the issue? Is this new demoralizing atmosphere into which he has been plunged to neutralize the pious teachings of early kittenhood at the deanery? Or will sound churchmanship prevail and keep him the cat he used to be?
If, said Mr. Mulliner, I'm right, in supposing that you want to know what happened the other evening, I can tell you. There was nothing that you could really call a war between his higher and lower selves. The lower self won, hands down. From the moment when he went on that first majestic toot, this once saintly cat became a bohemian of bohemians. His days started early and finished late, and were a mere welter of brawling and loose gallantry. As early as the end of the second week, his left ear had been reduced, through incessant gang warfare, to a mere tattered scenario, and his battle cry had become as familiar to the denizens of Bott Street, Chelsea, as the yodel of the morning milkman. The whiskey splash said it reminded him of some great Greek tragedy. Mr. Mulliner said, yes, there were points of resemblance.
And what, inquired the rum and milk, did Lancelot think of all that?
Lancelot, said Mr. Mulliner, had the easy live and let live creed of the artist. He was indulgent toward the animal's excesses. As he said to Gladys Bingley one evening when he was bathing Webster's right eye in a boric solution, cats will be cats. In fact, he would scarcely have given a thought to the matter had there not arrived one morning from his uncle a wireless message dispatched in mid-ocean announcing that he had resigned his bishopric for reasons of health
and would shortly be back in England once more. The communication ended with the words, "All my best to Webster." If you recall the position of affairs between Lancelot and the Bishop of Bongo Bongo as I described them the other night, said Mr. Mulliner, you will not need to be told how deeply this news affected the young man. It was a bombshell. Lancelot, though earning enough by his brush to support himself, had been relying on touching his uncle for that extra bit which would enable him to marry Gladys Bingley. And when he had been placed in loco parentis to Webster, he had considered his touch a certainty. Surely, he told himself, most ordinary gratitude would be sufficient to cause his uncle to unbelt. But now what? You saw that wireless that had Lancelot agitatedly discussing the matter with Gladys. You remember the closing words, "All my best to Webster." Uncle Theodore's first act on landing in England would be undoubtedly to hurry here for a sacred reunion with his cat. And what will he find? A feline plug ugly. A gangster. The big shot of Bott Street. "Look at the animal now," said Lancelot, waving a distracted hand at the cushion where it lay. "Run your eye over him, I ask you." Certainly Webster was not a natty spectacle. Some tough cats from the public house on the corner had recently been trying to muscle in on his personal dustbin, and though he had fought them off, the affair had left its mark upon him. A further section had been removed from his already abbreviated ear. His once sleek flanks were short of several patches of hair. He looked like the late Legs Diamond after a social evening with a few old friends. "What," proceeded Lancelot, writhing visibly, "will Uncle Theodore say on beholding that wreck? He will put the entire blame on me. He will insist that it was I who dragged that fine spirit down into the mire, and foot will go any chance I ever had of getting into his ribs for a few hundred quid for honeymoon expenses." Gladys Bingley struggled with a growing helplessness. "You don't think a good wig maker could do something?" "A wig maker might patch on a little extra fur," admitted Lancelot, "but how about that ear?" "A facial surgeon," suggested Seth. Lancelot shook his head. "It isn't merely his appearance," he said. "It's his entire personality. The poorest reader of character meeting Webster now would recognize him for what he is, a hard egg and a bad citizen." "When do you expect your uncle?" asked Gladys after a pause. "At any moment. He must have landed by this time. I can't understand why he has not turned up." At this moment there sounded from the passage outside the plop of a letter falling into the box attached to the front door. Lancelot went listlessly out. A few moments later, Gladys heard him utter a surprised exclamation, and he came hurrying back, a sheet of notepaper in his hand. "Listen to this," he said, "from Uncle Theodore." "Is he in London?" "No, down in Hampshire, at a place called Widdrington Manor. And the great point is, he does not want to see Webster yet." "Why not?" "I'll read you what he says," and Lancelot proceeded to do so as follows. "Widdrington Manor, Bottleby and the Vale, Hants. My dear Lancelot, you will doubtless be surprised that I have not hastened to greet you immediately upon my return to these halls. The explanation is that I am being entertained at the above address by Lady Widdrington, widow of the late George Widdrington, CBE, and her mother, Mrs. Poteley Banks, whose acquaintance I made on shipboard during my voyage home. I find our English side charming after the somewhat desolate environment of Bongo Bongo, and am enjoying a pleasant and restful visit. Both Lady Widdrington and her mother are kindness itself, especially the former, who is my constant companion on every country ramble. We have a strong bond in our mutual love of cats. And this, my dear boy, brings me to the subject of Webster. As you can readily imagine, I am keenly desirous of seeing him once more and noting all the evidences of the loving care which I have no doubt you have lavished upon him in my absence. But I do not wish to forward him to me here. The fact is, Lady Widdrington, though a charming woman, seems entirely lacking in discrimination in the matter of cats. She owns and is devoted to a quite impossible orange-colored animal by the name of Percy, whose society could not but prove distasteful to one of Webster's high principles. When I tell you that only last night this Percy was engaged in personal combat, quite obviously from the worst of motives, with a large tortoiseshell beneath my very window, you will understand what I mean. My refusal to allow Webster to join me here is, I fear, puzzling my kind hostess. Who knows how greatly I miss him, but I must be firm. Keep him, therefore, my dear Lancelot, until I call in person, when I shall remove him to the quiet rural retreat, where I plan to spend the evening of my life. With every good wishes to you both, your affectionate uncle, Theodore. Gladys Bingley had listened intently to this letter, and as Lancelot came to the end of it, she breathed a sigh of relief. "Well, that gives us a bit of time," she said. "Yes," agreed Lancelot. "Time to see if we can't awaken this animal some faint echo of its old self-respect. From today, Webster goes into domestic seclusion. I shall take him round to the vets with instructions that he be forced to lead the simple life. In those pure surroundings, with no temptations, no late nights, plain food, and a strict milk diet, he may become himself again." "The man who came back," said Gladys. "Exactly," said Lancelot. And so, for perhaps 2 weeks, something approaching tranquility reigned once more in my cousin Edward's son's studio at Bott Street, Chelsea. The veterinary surgeon issued encouraging reports. He claimed a distinct improvement in Webster's character and appearance, though he added that he would still not care to meet him at night in a lonely alley. And then one morning there arrived from his uncle Theodore a telegram which caused the young man to knit his brows in a bewilderment. It ran thus. "On receipt of this, come immediately. Widdrington Manor prepared for indefinite visit period. Circumstances, comma, I regret to say, comma, necessitate innocent deception, semicolon. So you will state on arrival that you're my legal representative and have come to discuss important family matters with me, period. Will explain fully when see you, comma, but rest assured, comma, my dear boy, comma, that would not ask this were it not absolutely essential, period. Do not fail me, period. Regards to Webster." Lancelot finished reading this mysterious communication and looked at Gladys with raised eyebrows. There is, unfortunately, in most artists, a material streak which lends them to place an unpleasant interpretations on telegrams like this. Lancelot was no exception to the rule. "The old boy's been having a couple," was his verdict. Gladys, a woman and therefore more spiritual, demurred. "It sounds to me," she said, "more as if he had gone off his onion. Why should he want you to pretend to be a lawyer? He says he will explain fully, but how do you pretend to be a lawyer?" Lancelot considered. "Lawyers cough dryly, I know that." "And then I suppose one would put the tips of the fingers together a good deal and talk about Rex versus Biggs Limited and
torts and malfeasances and so on. I think I could give a reasonably realistic impersonation.
Well, if you're going, you'd better start practicing. Oh, I'm going all right, said Lancelot. Uncle Theodore is evidently in trouble of some kind, and my place is by his side. If all goes well, I might be able to bite his ear before he sees Webster. How much ought we to have in order to get married comfortably?
At least 500.
I will bear it in mind, said Lancelot, coughing dryly and putting the tips of his fingers together. Lancelot had hoped, on arriving at Widdrington Manor, that the first person he met would be his Uncle Theodore explaining fully. But when the butler ushered him into the drawing-room, only Lady Widdrington, her mother Mrs. Pulteney Banks, and her cat Percy were present. Lady Widdrington shook hands. Mrs. Pulteney Banks bowed from the armchair, in which she sat swathed in shawls. But when Lancelot advanced with the friendly intention of tickling the cat Percy under the right ear, he gave the young man a cold, evil look out of the corner of his eye, and backing a pace, took an inch of skin off his hand with one well-judged swipe of a steel-pronged jaw. Lady Widdrington stiffened.
I'm afraid Percy does not like you, she said in a distant voice.
They know, said Mrs. Pulteney Banks darkly.
She knitted and purled a moment, musing.
Cats are cleverer than we think, she added.
Lancelot's agony was too keen to permit him even to cough dryly. He sat into a chair and surveyed the little company with watering eyes. They looked to him a hard bunch. Of Mrs. Pulteney Banks, he could see little but a cocoon of shawls. But Lady Widdrington was right out in the open, and Lancelot did not like her appearance. The chatelaine of Widdrington Manor was one of those agate-eyed, purposeful, tweed-clad women of whom rural England seems to have a monopoly. She was not unlike what he imagined Queen Elizabeth must have been in her day, a determined and vicious specimen. He marveled that even a mutual affection for cats could have drawn his gentle uncle to such a one. As for Percy, he was pure poison. Orange of body and inky black of soul, he lay stretched out on the rug, exuding arrogance and hate. Lancelot, as I have said, was tolerant of toughness in cats, but there was about this animal none of Webster's jolly, wholehearted, swashbuckling rowdiness. Webster was the sort of cat who would charge, roaring and ranting, to dispute with some rival the possession of a decaying sardine. But there's no more vice in him than in the late John L. Sullivan. Percy, on the other hand, for all his sleek exterior, was mean and bitter. He had no music in his soul, and was fit for treasons, stratagems, and spoils. One could picture him stealing milk from a sick tabby. Gradually, the pain of Lancelot's wound began to abate, but it was succeeded by a more spiritual discomfort. It was plain to him that the recent episode had made a bad impression on the two women. They obviously regarded him with dislike and suspicion. The atmosphere was frigid, and conversation proceeded jerkily. Lancelot was glad when the dressing gong sounded and he could escape to his room. He was completing the tying of his tie when the door opened and the Bishop of Bongo Bongo entered.
"Lancelot, my boy," said the bishop.
"Uncle," cried Lancelot. They clasped hands. More than 4 years had passed since these two had met, and Lancelot was shocked at the other's appearance. When last he had seen him at the dear old deanery, his Uncle Theodore had been a genial, robust man who wore his gaiters with an air.
Now in some subtle way he seemed to have shrunk. He looked haggard and haunted. He reminded Lancelot of a rabbit with a good deal on his mind. The bishop had moved to the door. He opened it and glanced along the passage. Then he closed it and, tiptoeing back, spoke in a cautious undertone.
"It was good of you to come, oh, my dear boy."
"Why, of course I came," replied Lancelot heartily. "Are you in trouble of some kind, Uncle Theodore?"
"In the gravest trouble," said the bishop, his voice a mere whisper.
He paused for a moment. "You have met Lady Whittington?"
"Yes."
"Then when I tell you that unless ceaseless vigilance is exercised, I shall undoubtedly propose marriage to her, you will appreciate my concern."
Lancelot gaped.
"But why do you want to do a potty thing like that?"
The bishop shivered. "I don't want to do it, my boy. Nothing is further from my wishes. The salient point, however, is that Lady Whittington and her mother want me to do it, and you must have seen for yourself that they are strong, determined women. I fear the worst."
He tottered to a chair and dropped into it, shaking. Lancelot regarded him with affectionate piety. "When did this start?"
"On board ship," said the bishop. "Have you ever made an ocean voyage, Lancelot?"
"I've been to America a couple of times."
"That can scarcely be the same thing," said the bishop musingly. "The transatlantic trip is so brief, and you do not get those nights of tropic moon. But even on your voyages to America, you must have noted the peculiar attitude toward the opposite sex induced by the salt air."
"They all look good to you at sea," agreed Lancelot.
"Precisely," said the bishop. "And during a voyage, especially at night, one finds oneself expressing oneself with a certain warmth which even at the time one tells oneself is injudicious." "I fear that on board the liner with Lady Whittington, my dear boy, I rather let myself go."
Lancelot began to understand. "You shouldn't have come to her house," he said. "When I accepted the invitation, I was, if I use a figure of speech, still under the influence. It was only after I had been here some 10 days that I awoke to the realization of my peril."
"Why didn't you leave?"
The bishop groaned softly. "They would not permit me to leave. They counted every excuse. I am virtually a prisoner in this house, Lancelot. The other day I said I had urgent business with my legal adviser and that this made it imperative that I should proceed immediately to the metropolis."
"That should have worked."
"It did not." "It failed completely. They insisted that I invite my legal adviser down here where my business could be discussed in the calm atmosphere of the Hampshire countryside. I endeavored to reason with them, but they were firm." "You do not know how firm women can be," said the bishop, shivering, "till you have placed yourself in my unhappy position. How well I appreciate now that powerful image of Shakespeare's, the one about grappling with hoops of steel. Every time I meet Lady Whittington, I feel those hoops drawing me ever closer to her. And the woman repels me even as that cat of hers repels me. Tell me, my boy, to turn for an instant to a pleasanter subject, how is my dear Webster?"
Lancelot hesitated. "Full of beans," he said.
"He is on a diet?" asked the bishop anxiously. "The doctor has ordered vegetarianism."
"Just an expression," exclaimed Lancelot, "to indicate robustness."
"Ah," said the bishop, relieved. "And what disposition have you made of him in your absence? He is in good hands, I trust."
"The best," said Lancelot. "His host is the ablest veterinary in London.
Dr. J.G. Robinson of 9 Bott Street, Chelsea, a man not only skilled in his profession, but of the highest moral tone. I knew I could rely on you to see that all was well with him, said the bishop emotionally. Otherwise, I would have shrunk from asking you to leave London and come here. Strong shield of defense, though you will be to me in my peril. Oh, but what use can I be to you? Said Lancelot, puzzled. The greatest, said the bishop. Your presence will be invaluable. You must keep the closest eye upon Lady Widdrington and myself. And whenever you observe us wandering off together, she is assiduous in her efforts to induce me to visit the Rose Garden in her company, for example. You must come hurrying up and detach me with the ostensible purpose of discussing legal matters. By these means we may avert what I had come to regard as the inevitable. I understand thoroughly, said Lancelot. A jolly good scheme. Rely on me. The ruse I have outlined, said the bishop regretfully, involves, as I hinted in my telegram, a certain innocent deception. But at times like this, one cannot afford to be too nice in one's methods. By the way, under what name did you make your appearance here? I used my own. I would have preferred Polkinghorne or Gooch or Withers, said the bishop pensively. They sound more legal. However, that is a small matter. The essential thing is that I'm relying on you to stick around? Exactly, to adhere. From now on, my boy, you must be my constant shadow. And if, as I trust, our efforts are rewarded, you will not find me ungrateful. In the course of a lifetime, I have contrived to accumulate no small supply of this world's goods. And if there is any little venture or enterprise for which you require a certain amount of capital, I'm glad, said Lancelot, that you brought this up, Uncle Theodore. As it so happens, I am badly in need of £500 and could indeed do with 1,000. The bishop grasped his hands. See me through this ordeal, my boy, and you shall have it. For what purpose do you require this money? I want to get married. Ugh, said the bishop, shuddering strongly. Well, he went on, recovering by himself. It is no affair of mine. No doubt you know your own mind best. I must confess, however, that the mere mention of the Holy State occasions in me an indefinable sinking feeling. But, of course, you are not proposing to marry Lady Widdrington. And nor, cried Lancelot heartily, are you, Uncle. Not while I'm around. Tails up, Uncle Theodore, tails up. Tails up, replied the bishop dutifully. But he spoke the words without any real ring of conviction in his voice. It was fortunate in the days that followed my cousin Edward's son Lancelot was buoyed up not only by the prospect of collecting £1,000, but also by a genuine sympathy and pity for a well-loved uncle. Otherwise he must have faltered and weakened. To a sensitive man, and all artists are sensitive, there are few things more painful than the realization that he is an unwelcome guest. And not even if he had had the vanity of a Narcissus could Lancelot have persuaded himself that he was persona grata at Widdrington Manor. The march of civilization has done much to curb the natural ebullience of a woman. It has brought to her the power of self-restraint. In emotional crises nowadays, women seldom give physical expression to their feelings, and neither Lady Widdrington nor her mother, the aged Mrs. Pulteney Banks, actually struck Lancelot or spiked him with a knitting needle. But there were moments when they seemed only by a miracle of strong will to check themselves from such manifestations of dislike. As the days went by, and each day the young man skillfully broke up a promising tete-a-tete,
The atmosphere grew more tense and electric. Lady Ridgington spoke dreamily of the excellence of the train service between Bottleby and the Vale and London, paying a particularly marked tribute to the 8:45 a.m. express. Mrs. Portly Banks mumbled from among her shawls of great gawks. She did not specify more exactly, courteously refraining from naming names, who spent their time idling in the countries where they were not wanted, when their true duty and interest lay in the metropolis. The cat Percy, by word and look, continued to affirm his low opinion of Lancelot. To make matters worse, the young man could see that his principal's morale was becoming steadily lowered. Despite the uniform success of their maneuvers, it was evident that the strain was proving too severe for the bishop. He was plainly cracking. A sense of hopelessness had crept into his demeanor. More and more, he came to resemble a rabbit who, fleeing from a stoat, draws no cheer from the reflection that he is all right so far, but flings up his front paws in a gesture of despair, as if to ask what profit there can be in attempting to evade the inevitable. And at length, one night, when Lancelot had switched off his light and composed himself for sleep, it was switched on again, and he perceived his uncle standing by the bedside with a haggard expression on his fine features. At a glance, Lancelot saw the good old man had reached breaking point. "Something the matter, uncle," he said. "My boy," he cried, "we're undone." "Oh, surely not," said Lancelot, as cheerily as his sinking heart would permit. "Undone," said the bishop hollowly. "Tonight Lady Ridgington specifically informed me that she wishes you to leave the house." Lancelot drew in his breath sharply. Natural optimist though he was, he could not minimize the importance of this news. "She has consented to allow you to remain for another 2 days, and then the butler has instructions to pack your belongings in time for the 8:45 express." said Lancelot. Indeed, said the bishop. "This means that I should be left alone and defenseless, and even with you sedulously watching over me, it has been a very near thing once or twice. That afternoon in the summer house." "And that day in the shrubbery," said Lancelot. There was a heavy silence for a moment. "What are you going to do?" asked Lancelot. "I must think, think well," said the bishop. "Good night, my boy." He left the room with bowed head, and Lancelot, after a long period of wakeful meditation, fell into a fitful slumber. From this he was aroused some 2 hours later by an extraordinary commotion somewhere outside his room. The noise appeared to proceed from the hall, and donning a dressing gown, he hurried out. A strange spectacle met his eyes. The entire numerical strength of Widdrington Manor seemed to have assembled in the hall. There was Lady Widdrington in a mauve negligee, Mrs. Pulteney Banks in a system of shawls, the butler in pajamas, a footman or two, several maids, the odd job man, and the boy who cleaned the shoes. They were gazing in manifest astonishment at the Bishop of Bongo Bongo, who stood fully clothed near the front door, holding in one hand an umbrella and in the other a bulging suitcase. In the corner sat the cat, Percy, swearing in a quiet undertone. As Lancelot arrived, the bishop blinked and looked dazedly about him. Where am I? He said. Willing voices informed him that he was at Ridgington Manor, Bottleby in the Bay, hence the butler going so far as to add the telephone number. I think, said the bishop, I must have been walking in my sleep.
Indeed, said Mrs. Pulteney Banks.
And Lancelot could detect a certain dryness in her tone.
I'm sorry to have been the cause of robbing the household of its well-earned slumber, said the bishop nervously. Perhaps it would be best if I now retired to my room.
quite, said Mrs. Pulteney Banks.
Once again, her voice cackled dryly. I'll come and tuck you up.
Oh, thank you, my boy, said the bishop.
Safe from observation in his bedroom, the bishop sank wearily on the bed and allowed the umbrella to fall hopelessly to the floor.
It is fate, he said. Why struggle further?
What happened? Asked Lancelot.
I thought matters over, said the bishop, and decided that my best plan would be to escape quietly under cover of the night. I had intended to wire to Lady Widdrington on the morrow that urgent matters of personal importance had necessitated a sudden visit to London, and just as I was getting the front door open, I trod on that cat.
Percy, said the bishop bitterly. He was prowling about in the hall on who knows what dark errand. It is some small satisfaction to me in my distress to recall I must have flattened out his tail properly. I came down on it with my full weight, and I am not a slender man.
Well, he said, sighing drearily, this is the end. I give up. I yield.
Oh, don't say that, uncle.
I do say that with some asperity. Well, else is it a sir?
It was a question which Lancelot found himself unable to answer. Silently, he pressed the other's hand and walked out. In Mrs. Pulteney Banks' room, meanwhile, an earnest conference was taking place.
Walking in his sleep, indeed, said Mrs. Pulteney Banks.
Lady Widdrington seemed to take exception to the older woman's tone. Why shouldn't he walk in his sleep, she retorted.
Why should he?
Because he was worrying.
Worrying? Sniffed Mrs. Pulteney Banks.
Yes, worrying, said Lady Widdrington with spirit, and I know why. You don't understand Theodore as I do.
As slippery as an eel, grumbled Mrs. Pulteney Banks. He was trying to slip off to London.
Exactly, said Lady Widdrington, to his cat. You don't understand what it means to Theodore to be separated from his cat. I have noticed for a long time that he was restless and ill at ease. The reason is obvious. He is pining for Webster. I know what it is myself. That time when Percy was lost for 2 days, I nearly went off my head. Directly after breakfast tomorrow, I shall wire to Dr. Robinson of Bott Street, Chelsea, in whose charge Webster now is, to send him down here by the first train. Apart from anything else, he will be nice company for Percy.
Cha,
said Mrs. Pulteney Banks. What do you mean, cha, demanded Lady Widdrington.
I mean, cha,
said Mrs. Pulteney Banks. An atmosphere of constraint hung over Widdrington Manor throughout the following day. The natural embarrassment of the bishop was increased by the attitude of Mrs. Pulteney Banks, who had contracted a habit of looking at him over her zareba of shawls and sniffing meaningly. It was with relief that towards the middle of the afternoon he accepted Lancelot's suggestion that they should repair to the study and finish up what remained of their legal business. The study was on the ground floor, looking out onto pleasant lawns and shrubbery. Through the open window came the scent of summer flowers. It was a scene which would have soothed the most bruised soul, but the bishop was plainly unable to draw refreshment from it. He sat with his head in his hands, refusing all Lancelot's well-meant attempts at consolation. Those sniffs, he said, shuddering, as if they still rang in his ears, what meaning they held, what a sinister significance. She may just have got a cold in the head, urged Lancelot. No, the meaning went deeper than that. They meant that that terrible old woman saw through my subterfuge last night. She read me like a book, and from now on there will be added vigilance. I shall not be permitted out of their sight, and the end can only be a question of time. Lancelot, my boy, said the bishop, extending a trembling hand pathetically towards his nephew,
you are a young man on the threshold of life. If you wish that life to be a happy one, always remember this. When on an ocean voyage, never visit the boat deck after dinner. You will be tempted. You will say to yourself that the lounge is stuffy and that the cool breezes will correct that replete feeling which so many of us experience after the evening meal. You will think how pleasant it must be up there with the rays of the moon turning the waves to molten silver. But don't go, my boy. Don't go. Right ho, uncle, said Lancelot soothingly. The bishop fell into a moody silence. It is not merely, he resumed, evidently having followed some train of thought, that as one of nature's bachelors, I regard the married state with alarm and concern. It is the particular conditions of my tragedy that render me distraught. My lot, once linked to that of Lady Widdrington, I shall never see Webster again. Mm. Oh, come, uncle, this is morbid. The bishop shook his hand. No, he said. If this marriage takes place, my path and Webster's must divide. I could not subject that pure cat to life at Widdrington Manor, a life involving, as it would, the constant society of the animal Percy. He would be contaminated. You know Webster Ancelot. He has been your companion, may I not almost say your mentor? For months. You know the loftiness of his ideals. For an instant, a picture shot through Lancelot's mind, the picture of Webster as he had seen him only a brief while since, standing in the yard with the backbone of a herring in his mouth, crooning a war song at the alley cat from whom he had stolen the bamboo. But he replied without hesitation, "Oh, rather. They are very high, extremely high." "And his dignity," said the bishop. "I deprecate a spirit of pride and self-esteem, but Webster's dignity was not tainted with those qualities. It rested on a clear conscience, and the knowledge that even as a kitten he had never permitted his feet to stray. I wish you could have seen Webster as a kitten, Lancelot." "I wish I could, uncle." "He never played with balls of wool, preferring to sit in the shadow of the cathedral hall, listening to the clear singing of the choir as it melted on the sweet stillness of the summer day. Even then you could see that deep thoughts exercised his mind. I remember once, but the reminiscence, unless some day it made its appearance in the good man's memoirs, was destined to be lost to the world." For at this moment the door opened and the butler entered. In his arms he bore a hamper, and from this hamper there appeared the wrathful ejaculations of a cat who has had a long train journey under constricted conditions and is beginning to ask what it's all about. "Bless my soul," cried the bishop, startled. A sickening sensation of doom darkened Lancelot's soul. He had recognized that voice. He knew what was in that hamper. "Stop, stop, Uncle Theodore, don't open that hamper." But it was too late. Already the bishop was cutting the strings with a hand that trembled with eagerness. Chirruping noises proceeded from him in his eyes with a wild gleam seen only in the eyes of cat lovers restored to their loved one. "Webster," he called in a shaking voice. And out of the hamper shot Webster, full of strange oaths. For a moment he raced about the room, apparently searching for the man who had shut him up in the thing, for there was flame in his eye. Becoming calmer, he sat down and began to lick himself, and it was then for the first time that the bishop was enabled to get a steady look at him. 2 weeks' residence at the vet's had done something for Webster, but not enough. Not, Lancelot felt agitatedly, nearly enough.
A mere fortnight's seclusion cannot bring back fur to lacerated skin, and it cannot restore to a chewed ear that extra inch which makes all the difference. Webster had gone to Dr. Robinson, looking as if he had just been caught in machinery of some kind. And that was how, though in a very slightly modified degree, he looked now. And at the sight of him, the bishop uttered a sharp, anguished cry. Then turning to Lancelot, he spoke in a voice of thunder, "So this, Lancelot Milliner, is how you have fulfilled your sacred trust!" Lancelot was shaken, but he contrived to reply, "It wasn't my fault, Uncle. There was no stopping him." "Chaw!" "Well, there wasn't," said Lancelot. "Besides, what harm is there in an occasional healthy scrap with one of the neighbors? Cats will be cats." "A sorry piece of reasoning," said the bishop, breathing heavily. "Personally," Lancelot went on, though speaking dully, for he realized how hopeless it was, "if I owned Webster, I should be proud of him. Consider his record," said Lancelot, warming as he proceeded. "He comes to Bott Street without as much as a single fight under his belt, and, despite this inexperience, shows himself possessed of such natural, genuine talent that in 2 weeks he has every cat for streets around, jumping walls and climbing lampposts at the mere sight of him." "I wish," said Lancelot, now carried away by his theme, "that you could have seen him clean up a poose-colored Tom from number 11. It was the finest sight I have ever witnessed. He was conceding pounds to this animal, who in addition had a reputation extending as far afield as the Fulham Road. The first round was even with the exchanges, perhaps a shade in favor of his opponent. But when the gong went for round two," the bishop raised his hand. His face was drawn. "Enough," he cried. "I am inexpressibly grieved. I..." He stopped. Something had leaped upon the windowsill at his side, causing him to start violently. It was the cat, Percy, who, hearing a strange feline voice, had come to investigate. There were days when Percy, mellowed by the influence of cream and the sunshine, could become, if not agreeable, at least free from active venom. Lancelot had once seen him actually playing with a ball of paper. But it was evident immediately that this was not one of those days. Percy was plainly in evil mood. His dark soul gleamed from his narrow eyes. He twitched his tail to and fro, and for a moment stood regarding Webster with a hard sneer. Then, waggling his whiskers, he said something in a low voice. Until he spoke, Webster had apparently not observed his arrival. He was still cleaning himself after the journey. But hearing this remark, he started and looked up. And as he saw Percy, his ears flattened and the battle light came into his eye. There was a moment's pause. Cat stared at cat. Then, swishing his tail to and fro, Percy repeated his statement in a louder tone. And from this point, Lancelot tells me, he could follow the conversation word for word as easily if he had studied cat language for years. This, he says, is how the dialogue ran. Webster, who? Me? Percy, yeah, you. Webster, a what? Percy, you heard. Webster, is that so? Percy, yeah. Webster, yeah? Yeah. Come on up here and I'll bite the rest of your ear off. Webster, yeah, you and who else? Percy, come on up here, I dare you. Webster, flushing hotly. You do you? Of all the nerve, of all the crust, why, I've eaten better cats than you before breakfast. To Lancelot, here, hold my coat and stand to one side. Now then. And with this, there was a whizzing sound, and Webster had advanced in full battle order. A moment later, a tangled mass that looked like 17 cats in close communion fell from the windowsill into the room.
A catfight of major importance is always a spectacle worth watching. But Lancelot tells me that, vivid and stimulating though this one promised to be, his attention was riveted not upon it, but upon the Bishop of Bongo Bongo. In the first few instants of the encounter, the prelate's features had betrayed no emotion beyond a grievous alarm and pain. "How thou art fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning," he seemed to be saying, as he watched his once blameless pet countering Percy's onslaught, which had the appearance of being about 16 simultaneous legs, with what had the appearance. And then, almost abruptly, there seemed to awaken in him, at the same instant, a passionate pride in Webster's prowess, and that sporting instinct which lies so near the surface in all of us. Crimson in the face, his eyes gleaming with partisan enthusiasm, he danced round the combatants, encouraging his nominee with word and gesture. "Oh, capital, excellent, all stoutly struck, Webster." "Hook him with your left, Webster," cried Anselot. "Precisely," boomed the bishop. "Soak him, Webster." "Indubitably," agreed the bishop. "The expression is new to me, but I appreciate its pith and vigor." "By all means, soak him, dear Webster." It was at this moment that Lady Widdrington, attracted by the noise of battle, came hurrying into the room. She was just in time to see Percy run into a right swing and bound for the windowsill, closely pursued by his adversary. Long since, Percy had begun to realize that, in inviting this encounter, he had gone out of his class and come up against something hot. All he wished for now was flight. But Webster's hat was still in the ring, and cries from without told that the battle had been joined once more on the lawn. Lady Widdrington stood appalled. In the agony of beholding her pet so manifestly getting the loser's end, she had forgotten her matrimonial plans. She was no longer the calm, purposeful woman who intended to lead the bishop to the altar if she had to use chloroform. She was the outraged cat lover, and she faced him with blazing eyes. "What?" she demanded. "Is this meaning of this?" The bishop was still laboring under obvious excitement. "That beastly animal of yours asked for it, and did Webster give it to him?" Did he, said Lancelot. "That corkscrew punch with the left, that sort of quick uppercut with the right," cried the bishop. "There isn't a cat in London that could beat him." "In London," said the bishop warmly, "in the whole of England. Oh, admirable Webster." Lady Widdrington stamped a furious foot. "I insist that you destroy that cat."
"Which cat?"
"That cat," said Lady Widdrington, pointing. Webster was standing on the windowsill. He was panting slightly, and his ear was in worse repair than ever. But on his face was the satisfied smile of a victor. He moved his head from side to side as if looking for the microphone through which his public expected him to speak a modest word or two. "I demand that that savage animal be destroyed," said Lady Widdrington. The bishop met her eye steadily. "Madam," he replied, "I shall sponsor no such scheme." "You refuse?" "Most certainly I refuse. Never have I esteemed Webster so highly as at this moment. I consider him a public benefactor, a selfless altruist. For years, every right-thinking person must have yearned to handle that inexpressibly abominable cat of yours, as Webster has just handled him, and I have no feelings towards him, but there's gratitude and admiration. I intend, indeed personally, with my own hands, to give him a good plate of fish." Lady Widdrington drew in her breath sharply. "You will not do it here," she said. She pressed the bell. "Fotheringay," she said in a tense, cold voice as the butler appeared, "the bishop is leaving us tonight. Please see that his bags are packed for the 6:41. She swept from the room. The bishop turned to Lancelot with a benevolent smile.
It will just give me nice time, he said, to write you that check, my boy. He stooped and gathered Webster in his arms, and Lancelot, after one quick look at them, stole silently out. This sacred moment was not for his eyes.